Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world during the show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has had since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he's authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two young children now live in East Texas. Cliff, welcome back.
Howdy, Bill.
So last time we gave them a nice little conservation tip, and we always like to open up with a little refresher about last month's conservation tip. Can you give us some refresher material here?
Yeah, and I even mentioned an old comedian's name that the younger generation might not know or appreciate, but you and I grew up with Rodney Dangerfield, the guy who didn't get any respect, and I used that term or that phrase for the role of scavengers, or not the role, but the appearance of scavengers, that they don't belong, or they're the riffraff, they should stay over there, but we instead should remember that they have a service, ecosystem service, of cleaning up dead stuff. And that can reduce bacteria and diseases. I mentioned that last month, they can reduce rabies, anthrax, botulism, cholera, and a whole bunch of other things. And we profiled two species of scavengers that somewhat look alike, not after you get to know them, the turkey vulture and the black vulture. And so the main thing is to appreciate them. Don't worry if they're circling over you, they're not going to attack. It doesn't mean that death is coming. There's no symbolism there, but maybe you're standing near a site where a thermal is developing, and that's when I often see vultures circling around, if it's not over a roadkill, for example, or dead livestock in the field or something like that. But when the sun heats the earth, it reflects back up in air that's circulating, and that's creates the thermal that raptors and vultures and sandhill cranes and pelicans and a whole bunch of big birds use to gain altitude. And pilots understand thermals. And I've done wildlife surveys by small aircraft. And boy, if you hit a thermal, you'll know it, because all of a sudden there's a big bump. And all of a sudden your stomach is up where your throat it used to be, because it's sometimes so abrupt and so powerful. It can, you know, pick up a plane a few feet and you feel it. So that's a thermal, and that's what a lot of our vultures are using. But the main thing is to show them some respect, the vultures, and let them do their ecosystem service by keeping our roadways and pastures and forests clean of dead stuff.
Almost every creature out there has a purpose in the web of life. So you have to understand that it's a part of that web. It's one link in the chain, so to speak.
Yeah, and I'm sure our friend with our sister episodes of What's Bugging You, she's got a really uphill battle trying to convince people that roaches have a purpose.
Yeah.
And spiders have a purpose. And you know, the things that people usually don't enjoy having in their house. And so I remember, speaking of comedians, I'm a big Jim Gaffigan fan, and he's always talking about, you know, if the outdoors are so great, why are the bugs always trying to get into my house?
Right.
So, a little comedy there, which I appreciate, and the insect people certainly get it. Yeah. But
a lot more predators on the outside.
That's right. That's right. But they're often attracted to the lights, and so we've done a lot with, you know, reducing mercury vapor lights. That was a big attraction. And, you know, then that would attract a lot of birds. Night hawks and other nightjars would thus swoop around lights trying to capitalize on all these bugs. So it does impact birds as much as insects, but lights we've talked about in the past. That was one of our conservation tips, was to keep the skies dark. The astronomers get it, but I think the rest of the community needs to get it, that we don't need to have a whole lot of lights. It really messes up a lot of critters, and in migration for birds, it can lead to their demise. So in inclement weather, fog conditions, light can be a beacon, an attraction, and boom, that bird hits whatever's lit up, a building or a tower or something to that effect. So, but scavengers, let's get back to scavengers. I think they have a role, and we should respect that. And yeah, they have a value in our world. A lot of birds are insectivorous, and in general, we should appreciate that. If we didn't have birds to keep insect numbers in check, we could be really overrun. We've talked about predators and the role of hawks and owls to keep our rodent numbers in check. If we didn't have hawks and owls, and I'd even go farther and say snakes and things that we don't all like, that we would be overrun with rodents if we didn't have these predators. So respect these critters that are around us that are good neighbors to have.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight with any question about our avian world and birds in general at 800-552-8502. And each month we spotlight a specific bird. And what are you going to be spotlighting this month?
We're going to talk about the American robin. It's a type of thrush, has quite a repertoire, and we're going to listen to four different sound files for the robin. The robin's song is a rich, jumbly mess of whistles and warbles separated by tiny pauses as heard here. Again, that's the song of the robin. Next, we'll listen to two different call notes. That's different from a song, different context. So these call notes, and then we'll listen to a flight call. But first, let's hear call note example one. And then call note example two. Kind of a chuckle.
Those are vastly different.
Yep. And then lastly, an example of the robin's flight call right here.
Sounds almost like an alarm sound.
Yep. And you know, that's called a flight call because that's the unique call it gives while in flight. This is a very popular species, the robin. It's the official state bird of three states in the U.S., Connecticut, Wisconsin, and Michigan. My wife and I named our daughter, who's now 11 years old, after this species. This widespread bird does equally well in urban and rural settings, and is estimated at 380 million individuals in the U.S. and Canada, which, according to the new Partners in Flight Conservation Plan, makes the robin our number one most abundant land bird species in the U.S. and Canada. If you're curious, in second place, it's a tie between the blue-gray gnatcatcher and the chipping sparrow, while in third place is the dark-eyed junco. So let's get back to the robin. They eat a variety of insects, seeds, and berries, but they're best known for being an earthworm eater on mowed lawns. To tell the sexes apart, the chocolate brown on the head of the male is darker than that of its back. So the observer can see that contrast, whereas the brown on the back and the head are the same color as on the female. So check out a photo on our Bird Calls webpage that was snapped by James Childress for a robin picture. The species builds bulky, big, open-cut nests made out of sticks, coarse grasses, and stems. They place it in trees or shrubs. They lay several eggs, usually four, that are unmarked and sky blue in color. Sometimes, especially farther to our north, robins will build their nest in a windowsill or a building ledge, which often allow for great views of their nesting process. Young of the year that are out of the nest look similar to the parents, except their breast is heavily speckled and not fully orangey red yet. The robin nests in the Red River radio listening area, but the winter flocks we see, especially at communal roost sites, can number in the hundreds, if not thousands. And alongside the cedar waxwing, flocks of these two species can strip your berry-giving shrub or tree of ripe berries very quickly. Fruit travels rather quickly through the digestive tract of birds, so these flocks that find your holly or your black cherry tree also become pooping grounds where you don't want to have your car parked underneath, although the car wash companies sure don't mind. And when I pulled up to the studio at about 5:20 today, this evening, an hour ago, less, there were immense numbers of robins and other birds, namely starlings, going into roost right next door to the studio here. Mm. And they were going into the big grove of live oaks at the entrance of LSUS, right off of Urey Drive. And if I stood there for 30 minutes, I bet I would have counted thousands and thousands of robins. They were pouring in to roost there communally. So that's something, if you have never seen a communal roost of robins, a clear night like tonight, 5:20 p.m., get there a little early. 15 minutes is probably going to be more than enough time to really get the essence of it. But it's pretty neat to see them all coming in. You can hear the flight call that we just played. You have to pick out the other birds that are in there too, like right. The starlings. There are probably going to be some brown-headed cowbirds in there, although I didn't really notice any. But the robin was definitely the dominant bird in that roost just not even an hour ago. And here I am walking across the parking lot planning to talk about the robin. So it was very perfect timing that here we're right next to a mega roost for winter robins.
And I got here probably about 20 minutes before you, and they were all on the telephone lines.
Yeah.
They were just lined up, and you could just hear them caterwauling out there.
Yep.
Just there was this big cacophony of bird calls from a variety of different species. So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We welcome your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, and Karen York from Maine, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. I am calling with a question about woodpeckers.
Okay.
We live on a 5-acre wooded lot in Maine. It's a mixed pine oak forest, and we have lots of woodpeckers. We've got pileated and red-bellied and downy and hairy and northern flickers, and they love to make holes in the corners of our red cedar siding on our house, all four corners of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So when we first moved in, we had holes in the corners, and we put up some sort of crinkly foil tape on all four corners, and it kept the woodpeckers away pretty well. It's since disintegrated, and we've now gotten to the point where we're replacing the red cedar siding, and the woodpeckers are back.
Okay.
They love it.
Yep.
So I'm wondering if you have any advice for us on how to keep them away.
Well, what color is that wood siding that they're hitting?
So it's a stained, it's kind of like a natural sort of brownish stained cedar.
Yep. So it's wood colored, basically. And to them, the side of your house looks like a big tree. And to them, it looks like utopia, and let's conquer it, and let's put a cavity in. And I like the list of woodpeckers you've got there. It sounds like you know your birds. And several of those will chisel away at the side of a building. And what they're doing is they're not necessarily foraging. There are cases of that. And then if you go out to the southwest, there are acorn woodpeckers that chisel little holes and stuff that hole with an acorn. They store it, they cache it for later use. But I think what you have there in Maine is similar to what we have in Texas and Louisiana, and that's birds that are trying to make a cavity. Often they do it different times of the year, but right now there are flickers that are coming south to winter, and they don't have a place to sleep. So they'll carve a hole this time of the year down here in the south, and sometimes that can be on the side of a building. So they're looking to make a cavity to sleep in. Other times of the year, they'll do it for nesting purposes. Again, a cavity. So they think it's a tree. The cedar is really easy to chisel. And so there is a solution. And I've seen all kinds of gimmicks. Let me go through some of those. People say put up a rubber snake. Well, that doesn't work. Put up an owl decoy. That doesn't last 5 minutes. The birds get used to it. And then I've heard people that have had to spend buku dollars putting up vinyl siding because that's going to definitely solve the problem. But you can spend thousands of dollars doing that. And the most outrageous example I've heard is to put special made paint somebody came up with that has a pepper sauce flavor to it. Well, my comment is, that's clever if the bird was eating the wood or tasting the wood, but they're not. They're all chiseling it away with their bill, and there's, it's like your fingernail. It's not grabbing any sensation from heat from jalapeno pepper. So the best solution, Karen, is to really try to figure out which species is doing it. This and put up the appropriate size nest box, and you can go online and find all kinds of blueprints for nest boxes. And if you don't know which woodpecker, then here's an opportunity to put multiple sizes and shapes of woodpecker boxes up on the house, and that to me looks, it'll look funny, but the neighbors will want to talk about it, and there you have a conversation piece, and you spend a fraction of the cost of putting up the crinkly stuff you're talking about, or repeatedly getting up on ladders, which can be dangerous, or doing all these other gimmicks that cost money. So again, find online different blueprints for small, medium, and large woodpeckers. So find one for a downy, a red-bellied, that's the medium, the downy was a small, and then a large, which would be the pileated, and put them on the house, and that way they'll go to the box because that's what they want. That's ultimately what they're trying to do, is create a cavity, and you've done it for them and they will use it. So it's kind of like that phrase from Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. So Karen, there's your homework assignment, is to build a couple or three woodpecker houses and put them up where the damage occurs, because there's probably something to that side of the house. And typically for woodpeckers, they like to get that last bit of setting sun. So often woodpecker cavities are facing to the west or southwest, at least here. I don't know about up there. Shade has a lot to do with it. But you look to see where the damage is and focus your efforts on that side of the house. Does that make sense?
That's great. Yeah, I love the idea. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now if you have a question at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about birds in our avian world are welcome. And we're going to go next to Lorraine from Wynn Parish. Lorraine, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
My question has to do with several cardinals we've had around here. The two males, the wings were fluttering. This is not a feed thing. I understand that. But the little wings seemed more of an involuntary shivering rather than a voluntary one. And then today I saw one that his little feathers were all fluffed out. The thing was twice as big. It looked just twice as big as he should.
Yeah.
Like a turkey all puffed out. Do we have some kind of illness going among the red cardinals?
No. When they puff up like that, they're often preening. Or, when birds are cold, it's like a down jacket.
He was just sitting there, all puffed out.
Yeah, and they'll...
He wasn't moving.
Right, and he's doing that on purpose. So I don't think there's an illness that we need to worry about. I think he's doing it for a variety of reasons, but I think if you watch carefully, they're going to do it a lot when they're preening. They could be sunning if it's cold, sitting in the sun, and also if it's a cold day, they'll puff up to like that down jacket to stay warm. But no, I don't think there's anything to worry about. In the fluttering, it is a courtship thing in the adults. You'll see them do that. This time of the year, you won't see that, except maybe at a window or a mirror on the side of your car. They'll see their reflection, and they'll puff up, and they'll sometimes flutter, trying to look bad and mean to the reflection that to their pea-sized brain is an intruder. But to us, we're like, hey, dummy, you're just seeing your reflection. Well, he doesn't know that. So I'm wondering if one of those things is involved, playing out this cardinal fluttering and puffing up that you can watch, Lorraine. Does that all sound interesting, or possibilities,
well,
rather?
I've seen the cardinals. I'm not explaining it very well. Their wings were drooping. They were trying to eat. They weren't trying to interest the girls right then.
Well, okay, a sick bird is not going to do a lot of time eating and flying around. A sick bird usually goes over the corner and dies, or suffers for a long period and dies. So just that the fact that it's eating, to me, tells me that it's probably okay. There's probably some social dominance at the feeder. Maybe they're trying to flex to the other males, or the females try to look more colorful, more healthy. But I think just the fact that you've got some birds eating is a good sign, because usually when you're sick, just like with us, what's the first thing you don't want when you got a cold or flu? You're like, I don't want to eat anything. So that's pretty much the same thing with birds. So I would look for maybe more of a positive response or explanation of this, because I'm not going to have anything that leans towards illness, disease, or death for what you're seeing. The things you're seeing just sound normal. So I think you're in good shape.
I hope so, because a couple of years ago we had doves that were having trouble swallowing, and they were all plussed up, and I heard later that they had a virus among them. So I was afraid we might be getting something like that with the cardinals.
Yep, and the doves do have something different that they can transmit, but I'm not sure that same thing goes to cardinals from doves. I think it goes dove to dove, and even species to species of dove and pigeon, and that one is a problem, and that one is lethal, but I don't think cardinals suffer from that same thing.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah,
but I do. I have another question.
Okay,
is this when the house finches started during their migration?
Uh-huh.
We had a couple of males with yellow tails. Now, I understand that the food can have that, but where have they been eating so that they could get their feathers are yellow, not red?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. That you know, it is the food that determines the red, and so that the ones that don't have the red are lacking some of the vitamins and such in the food that results in the red. So it's what he's not eating. And so I don't know. I obviously am not going to know the answer of that, what that individual was eating or not eating, but he needs to probably get in shape and eat the right things, and that would be a lot more berries and seeds out in nature. And seeing a yellow one is not unusual in house finches. We see I don't know what the ratio is, but it's not unusual to see some yellow, even all the whole from top to bottom, the bird where it's supposed to be red will be yellow. That's not terribly unusual. Just go online and look up yellowy house finch and you'll find lots of pictures. So that bird's not, it's not going to kill the bird, it's just affecting its color. A lot of zoos have had to learn the hard way with keeping their flamingos in captivity to look bright pink. That's diet. And so zoos have learned that lesson in the last few decades of how to keep the flamingos pink, because, you know, back when they didn't figure it out, everybody comes see white flamingos and they're like, what's going on? Is this, you know, are your flamingos sick? They're not pink. And the kids know they're to be pink and they're not pink. And it's a lack of something in their diet. So they figured that out as well in the zoo industry. So, all right, Lorraine, well, thanks for the call and appreciate that. And Bill, before we go to the next caller, we need to alert our listeners about a video that's been out by Texas Parks and Wildlife. They did a video about this radio show. And if you want to see what it looks like, what we're doing here in the studio, I urge you to go to the Red River Radio homepage and paste it on there. Is a 8-minute YouTube video that Texas Parks and Wildlife did for our Parks and Wildlife TV show, and it's now on YouTube where you can go and look at that video, and you can see what Bill looks like and what I look like and how we're sitting here in the studio talking into microphones. And It's just a really neat little synopsis of the show for anybody that wants to get a visual of it. So definitely check it out.
And that is on our website at redriverradio.org, and it's all about bird calls, and you can visit that. And also you can go on YouTube as well. But the link is right there on our website. So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have two callers online and three lines open right now. We're going to go next to Jerry from Bossier City. Jerry, what's you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
All right. How you doing, Cliff?
Hey, I'm good, Jerry. How are you?
Good, good. I have a house that has an atrium in it, and it's no roof in there. Mm-hmm. And I have resident redbirds in there, and they've been coming in there and having babies now for about 10 or 15 years. Is there anything I should do to help them, or should I just leave them alone?
Well, it sounds like they're doing their business without any help, right? You just explain that they're nesting in there. So they're obviously, if you're going to feed young, you're finding enough food to fill your own belly and your baby's belly. So I don't think there is anything you need to do. If you really have to look at something to do, make sure that the plants in your atrium, that you lean more towards natives. There's lots of stuff you can plant that cardinals will eat, like beautyberry. So I don't know if you have that growing in your atrium or if you just have potted plants. I don't have a visual of what you've got, but that would be my only comment.
Yeah, I've got trees, and I really don't have any plants with berries, so that's an idea, plant a few berries. Huh?
Yeah, that's what I would recommend, and remember, go native. If it's called Chinese something, that's not native. We don't want it. So look for something that belongs in the area where you live, and that way it's acclimated, and you're not going to have to, put tarps on it when they say there's going to be a freeze tonight. The tropical plants, I mean, you talk about a headache. Tropical plants are a headache. They don't belong here. I know people like doing that, but I'd rather have something else to do than cover my darn plants. So natives are the way to go, and they have a role to play. They have an interaction with our native species, like the cardinal that you're mentioning. So bringing in tropical plants, it's just bringing in a foreigner, and it just doesn't mesh with what we've got. So
good.
Yep. All right, Jerry, well, you've got a homework assignment. Get some berry given bushes and trees in your atrium, and I think you'll be rewarded.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning birds in our avian world are welcome tonight. And we're going to go next to Danny from Keithville. Danny, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hello, Cliff. How you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Danny. How are you?
Doing great. Look, you probably talked about this before. It was about the house sparrows. I read something that if you would paint the porch ceiling blue, they call it Hank blue. I think some of the paint manufacturers actually have that blue. Is that true that they will not nest in your porch area?
Well, I've never seen that done. I know that some of the bird box people will do that. That is one of the tricks to keep wasps from building in your bird box, like bluebird boxes. If you ever, run bluebird boxes, you'll find that there's a lot of other things you're not targeting that want that cavity as well, that box, and red wasp being one of them. So some people paint it blue, the ceiling, and I don't know how that works, because, usually when you look inside a bird box, it's pretty darn pitch black in there, darkness, right? But then other people talk about, and I've done this, use a bar soap and rub that bar soap on the ceiling of your bird box, and that will be an unpleasant texture for the wasp. Now, you're asking about a porch. That'd be a heck of a lot of ivory soap, wouldn't it? But I don't know the answer, and I would say if you have the time to do the blue paint, try it and let us know after a while. Especially, though, if you have a problem with sparrows coming in there. So it's not going to work unless, you know, you can demonstrate that it's changing the bird's behavior. So do you have a problem right now with house sparrows?
Yes, I do. And I think the theory behind it is that because it's blue, it gives them the impression that they're in the sky rather than, you know, rather than actually in a surface.
Right. Yeah. And I've heard that argument that it emulates the sky, and I get it. But I don't get it when you're peering into a dark box. And you know, paint works on reflection of light, and there's not a whole lot of light going through a little hole of an eastern bluebird box unless the sun's just right.
Yeah, my problem is that they nest at the corners of my porch.
Uh-huh. Well,
and I'm just trying to get rid of them, that's all.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you're talking about the underside of your porch, if that blue, that baby blue, is going to be vastly different than the rest of your house, step back at the curb and see, is anybody even going to notice it? Except maybe the mailman, you know, or someone banging on the door. That would be the only people that are going to notice it. But it might look pretty cool. I mean, what's the color of the rest of your house?
It's a more of a beige.
Yeah. Well, I would try it. I mean, you're talking about average porch, a bucket of paint, and so, you know, you're looking at under $30, so it might be worth it. And then give us a call back after a couple of years and tell us if it worked.
I will.
Okay. All right,
okay,
Danny.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep, thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and all of our lines are open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We did have someone named Josh online, but that call dropped. So give us a call back, Josh, at 800-552-8502, and anybody else out there with a question right now. And at this point, we will go to what is going on with the Christmas bird count right now?
Yeah, this is a great time to start planning ahead for Christmas bird counts. If you've never done a Christmas bird count, they're a lot of fun. They've been around since the year 1900. It's a project where we go out in the Christmas season, not necessarily Christmas Day, but during the Christmas season, and there are these Christmas count circles. It's a 15-mile diameter circle. It's a 24-hour count period, and a compiler is in charge of making sure that the people involved are scattered in that 15-mile circle, and that way they're not duplicating effort, counting the same birds, etc. So you kind of want to spread your people out, and you want to make sure you cover different habitats. So, you know, the key with a Christmas bird count to get your numbers up is to make sure, number one, you have water. That's a really good way to boost your bird list, is to have a lake, some kind of open water. But then different forest types. If you've got pine forests over here, hardwood forests over there, field and pasture, different community types of plants would yield different variety of birds. So get with your compiler in your area, and that person will put you in with a group. Maybe if you're a beginner, you can say, hey, I've never done this before, and that compiler will try to hook you up with a subgroup that maybe has a very seasoned birder that can take you under their wing, so to speak. But the Christmas bird count period is December 14th to January 5th. And we're coming up on the 118th year of Christmas bird counts. There are about 117 plus or minus counts in Texas, my state. Here in Louisiana, there are about 25. But nationally, there are actually, National Audubon, they say that there's over 20 countries that have Christmas bird counts, and they have over 60,000 observers all over the planet. So it's pretty amazing. And in 2012, they had 2,400 species recorded on all those different Christmas counts all over the globe. So that's pretty neat. So what we'll do is I've communicated with several of the count compilers in the listening area here, and I'm going to send the information I've got to Bill, who'll put that up tomorrow on the Bird Calls website. And that'll include who the compiler is, their email address to contact them, and then the date, if we have it, of when it is. So where I live in Nacogdoches, the compilers are David and Mimi Wolf, and they've already set the date as December 17th in Nacogdoches. That's a Sunday. So they always go for the first Sunday of the count period. So this year it'll be December 17th. So I'll be busy in the Nacogdoches area counting birds with my colleagues there. So it's a lot of fun. And actually, we're going to end the show. I'm going to give a little teaser. We're going to end the show with a conservation tip that has to do with the Christmas count. And I'm going to leave it at that so people don't fall asleep or change the channel or get distracted with something else. So tune in, because the last two or three minutes of this hour, we will talk about a little bit more in depth on Christmas bird counts and their value.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We'd love to hear your questions about our avian world and birds in general, and you can give us a call again at 800-552-8502. So now we are dead into the migratory season right now. What can folks expect to pass through this way?
Well, I think migration's wrapping up. I like to think of mid-November, everything's pretty much in place. We saw a lot of movement depending on the groups of birds. Not all the birds pass through equally in, as far as timing. For instance, a lot of the shorebirds are way early, and a lot of the raptors are kind of in the middle, and so some things are a little bit on the late side. But right now, being mid-November, I think we're pretty settled in. There'll still be some things moving. There's always exceptions to the rule. People still might hear geese flying over if we get another cold front to trigger southbound movement in our geese. But you know, I really like this time of the year. There are several things that really flood our area with individuals, like northern flickers, yellow-bellied sapsuckers, hermit thrush, ruby-crowned kinglet. These are all birds that don't breed in our area but come here in the wintertime. And so this is a really good time to go out and see a lot of the birds that bred, you know, up in Wisconsin or southern Canada, and here they are looking for milder environments, and they're down here wintering with us. You know, we even call the people that do that, we give them a bird name, snowbirds. People that might live up in the Great Lakes in the summer when it's just spectacular, but goodness gracious, if you don't like shoveling snow and bundling up, then, you know, those snowbirds head south. Well, the real birds do that too. And I think those are the smartest ones because, you know, we often want to get out of this hot south, don't we, in the dead of summer. And so I think a lot of these birds are smart to go up there, like rose-breasted grosbeaks and Baltimore orioles and, you know, backyard birds that we see in migration that go farther north to breed. So right now I think we're dead set in winter, and I think a lot of these birds will be here with us for the next few months. The Christmas bird count really picks them up. And you know, in my backyard, I'm really hopeful that a bird that showed up on all days Halloween, October 31st, we had a rufous hummingbird in our backyard, and it's a female, and she has stuck around since Halloween, and so we're crossing our fingers that she'll stick around for the Christmas bird count, because my house is right on the northern edge of the 15-mile circle of the Nacogdoches Christmas count, and rufous hummingbird is not something we get every winter. And it's a bird that, you know, will survive if we keep feeders out, if we have, you know, right now Turk's cap is doing great, it's still in bloom until we get a first freeze, which we haven't had in my yard yet, but there are a lot of hardy hummingbirds that can make it through our cold winters, and the Christmas bird counts are a really great way to pick those up. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We do have four callers online right now. Please stay on the line. It's going to take us a few moments to get through you all, but first we're going to go to Paul from North Jasper County. Paul, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
I don't have a question. I'm going to call back in the spring with a question about vireos.
But, okay.
Right now, just reference to your earlier caller and the Haint Blue porch ceiling.
Uh-huh.
I have over 2,000 square feet of porch ceilings at mm-hmm. my house mm-hmm. on the Angelina River, and they're painted Haint Blue or mm-hmm. Bird's Egg Blue. And I don't know about birds, but it keeps wasps and dirt daubers from building their nest underneath on your porch.
So, okay.
And it works.
Cool, cool. And would you call it? You'd call it a sky blue or baby blue for those that are curious.
Yeah, it's in fact we bought bird's egg blue or robin's egg blue, I think it's called, but we had to lighten it a little bit more from that.
Okay.
And so it's called Haint Blue, and I've heard it called that as well, and that's what your caller was calling
yeah.
it. But it does work for flying insects, but it does not work for spiders, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it does work for wasps and dirt daubers because they'll build anywhere but on that blue ceiling.
Yeah,
I don't know about birds.
Okay, well that's very helpful, Paul. We appreciate your comment, firsthand comment on blue porches, and maybe we're going to start a revolution on blue porches.
And my wife will tell you that it's the same reason he mentioned was they think it's the sky.
Yeah.
They don't. And I don't know why it is.
Right, right. Pea-sized brain in some of these wasps. Huh? That
exactly.
Hard to process. But okay, well, thanks for the account there, Paul. Thank you very much.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. We have Tommy and Carlin. You are on hold for a few seconds. We're going to go next to Sarah from Longview. Sarah, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff.
Hey,
my question is about our cat. We, without much thinking, we just accepted a cat that someone was giving away. And we have a lot of gophers and rats around our place. And so we just thought that would be awesome. We'll get a cat and he'll help us with our problem.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that it totally killed the fun of our bird watching. We've always kept the bird feeder out with the black oil sunflower seeds. We've always had lots of cardinals and finches and just a little bit of everything that likes that kind of seed and coming and going all the time, and we enjoy watching them, especially when something new comes up and we've never seen before. I have four kids, and so we've all enjoyed it, and now that we have the cat, they're just not there anymore.
Yeah.
I was wondering, what's the best way to bring them in a way that the cat can't get to them, or is there...
Well, there's only one true solution. It's the way that my wife and family do our cats, is to keep them indoors all the time. So the cat's not going to be your solution for gopher problem because you just noticed it's also backfiring because it's killing the birds or at least scaring the birds away as well. So I would say keep the cat inside. That's for everybody. That's the best public message we can give on cats. If you love your cat, you'll find that it'll be healthier inside. It won't be fighting with other cats. It won't get run over. It won't get attacked by dogs or coyotes. A healthy cat is an indoor cat. A happy cat is an indoor cat. So try that. And then if you just can't stand the gophers, there are other ways to eradicate them. But, you know, if you're on a sandy upland site, that's you know, that home is for the gophers as well. I know that's an ankle breaker.
Yeah.
And I know it's bad. I lived in a place in college where it was on a hill, sandy hill, and you know, I'd mow and then, you know, you'd bog down the mower because of the mounds. It's annoying, I know that, but let me tell you, that's a job that you could spend the rest of your life doing, is trying to eradicate these things. I think it's just probably easier to just say, hey, we're up on a hill. The good news is we're never going to flood. maybe the bad news is we're going to have gophers and we're going to embrace them. I don't know if you like that answer or not. I had to learn
to
embrace
them. Fine with it. Yeah, I really don't mind them that much if they were just digging up the yard. I actually care less about the yard. I want to rip it all up and put in native grasses and plants. But my husband loves the yard, so I can't do it for him. But do the gophers, do they provide food for any birds, like owls or anything, or because they're always underground, are they not usually?
Well, the gophers do have a role. They're aerating your soil. That's helping a lot of your plants. And in turn, those plants are going to be healthier potentially. And maybe those plants are holding insects that the birds are going to eat, or producing seeds and fruits that the birds are going to eat. You have to look at it that way. So there's kind of a line in there. It's not a direct arrow from gopher to bird, but there are raptors that would eat a gopher, but they don't spend a lot of time out and about. If you watch a gopher, you'll maybe see the dirt kick up and maybe see a hint of fur, and that's it. You know, you got your 12 seconds over a 24-hour period, which is really tough for a raptor, but a really skillful cat will sit there and watch and wait, and when they see that dirt move, they'll grab it. But like I said, the cat, it's a lot easier to go after a cardinal or Carolina wren just sitting and waiting in the bushes, because one of those birds is going to come by, versus sitting there and waiting for that 12-second opportunity with a gopher.
So I'd
embrace the gopher. They're pretty cool. They've got a role to play, and trying to eradicate them, you might quit your day job if you think you're going to be successful.
All right. Well, that answers my question.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sarah.
I'm going to tell my husband.
Yep. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm having flashbacks of Caddyshack right now. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. If you have a question for Cliff tonight, you're listening to Bird Calls. We have Tommy up next. Carlin in Ferguson, please stay online. We'll get to you as soon as we can. Tommy from Carthage, you've got a question tonight for Cliff. You're online with him. Tommy?
Maybe it's somebody else's name.
Okay. Oh, Ferguson. Ferguson, are you online?
Yes.
Okay. I jumped the gun there. Ferguson, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Where are you calling from, Ferguson?
Anacostia.
Vernon Parish.
Okay. Leesville area.
Yes.
All right.
Anacostia.
All right.
A comment rather than a question. I tuned in late today, and you were finishing your talk about vultures. And years ago, I was in Luling, Texas, West Texas, and I was driving past, I believe it was the post office, and there was somebody outside walking, and there was a buzzard, and as best as my memory, it was a black vulture that was with the guy on the ground hopping, kind of behind him and off a little bit to one side. And I'd never seen a domesticated vulture before, but this one seemed to be pretty happy with his situation.
So he looked more like a pet than anything?
Yeah, he was just hopping along, kind of off to one side on the guy.
Yeah, that is unusual. It has to be that person maybe was a rehabilitator.
Maybe.
You know, and love the vulture so much he took him to the post office, which is bizarre. Boy, you wouldn't want to let that bird throw up or defecate inside the post office, because that's a nasty mess.
Well, they were outside, so I don't know if the bird was ever on the inside or not.
And you said that was Luling, Texas?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's south of Austin. That's the watermelon country. At least that's what's on their water tower, if I recall, and then there's a couple of really good barbecue joints there, but that's Central Texas. I know it well.
There's a group of people I believe really appreciate vultures, and that's parish or county road workers.
Job security, right?
they do a really good job at taking care of road kills.
Yeah, helps them out. That's right.
So, anyhow, that's all I have.
Okay, well, thanks, Ferguson. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, and you are listening to Bird Calls. We're going to go to Tommy next from Carthage, and if you have a question, you can call us at 800-552-8502. Carlin, you're going to be up next. Tommy, you're next. What's your question tonight?
Yeah, it was interesting to hear you talk about snow in the mountains, and that's kind of what it's related to. In the mountains in New Mexico and Colorado, we go up there for skiing, and there are scavenger birds that look like a raven, not like our crow, but something more along the raven. And I was just curious, of late, it seems as if I've seen some of those in East Texas, in the Walmart parking lots and those kind of things. And I was just curious if they indeed kind of have migrated into this area. I don't recall seeing those before.
Right. If you're talking about an all-black corvid in the Rocky Mountains, that's the northern raven. And that's a large bird with a pretty amazing repertoire. And they're scavengers. There's also black-billed magpies. They have a long tail. They're black and white. And when the sun hits them, there's some iridescent blue and green. They're really pretty. But neither of those are in this listening area. And so I wouldn't say that either one has migrated here. Instead, you know, we have American crows. It's not as large as the raven, but they're all black, and they also will scavenge for food. So you're not seeing the same thing. When you've got your ski duds on, you're seeing completely different stuff than back here at home.
Right. And I mean, these are so similar. And I know the crows are around here, but they just have that super long tail. And, just almost a magpie type
Of thing or something. Now, there are great-tailed grackles that are black. They're not as large as a corvid. A corvid is a term for ravens and crows. So if you're seeing an all-black bird with a long tail, there is the great-tailed grackle, G-R-A-C-K-L-E. So that's maybe what you're seeing. They're in big numbers at some of our parking lots. They really like urban areas. They're eating the French fries that we drop on the ground. Yep. And so you'll see them where someone's mowing. They'll sometimes follow mowers and eat the grasshoppers that have been maimed, and that makes them easy pickings, easy food. But I'm wondering if that's what you're seeing, are great-tailed grackles. And they're not a raven or crow relative. They're a blackbird relative.
Well, it was just it had a similarity, and I was just curious if they had indeed migrated to this area, but I guess the climate's too warm.
Yeah, and so when you go back skiing, you won't see great-tailed grackles up in the mountains. They're not up high. They're not, you know, you're skiing at 9,000-10,000 feet, I'm guessing, and there are no great-tailed grackles within hours of you there. Okay. All right.
Okay, super. All
Very
right,
good. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Tommy. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have two callers online. Joe, please hang on. We've got Carlin up first. Carlin, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. I'm a snowbird, just like you were describing there. I don't like to shovel snow either, and I hate cold weather. I come down here every year in the wintertime, and last year, to my amazement, I saw roseate spoonbill.
Okay.
Flying over, I live on a little lake.
Yeah.
And it was flying over the water. And everybody was saying, oh, no, there are no roseate spoonbills anywhere around here. Mm. But I saw it. I knew what I saw.
Right. Well, I'm glad you called it that, because most people would say it's a flamingo.
Not really.
You'll talk to a lot of anglers that will see a roseate spoonbill away from the coast, and they'll say, hey, we've got flamingos up here, but they're spoonbills. And so we do get those in the non-breeding season. They'll wander inland. Even into this listening area, starting usually in the dead of summer and into the fall. And if you had one in the winter time, that would be a pretty good record of one that spent the winter with us. They usually don't like to stay inland during the colder months. So hopefully you photographed it and maybe told some bird watchers, because that's a good sighting.
I probably wrote it down. I didn't photograph it, I was keeping bird records, I was on feeder watch last year.
Uh-huh.
It's probably somewhere in my feeder watch listing.
Yeah.
By the way, another question about snowbirds. Is it unusual to see a dark-eyed junco yet?
No. They'll start in small numbers showing up in I mean, even as early as September, in you know, small numbers, and as October rolls around, they can start coming, and by now they've all poured in. So it is not unusual to see a dark-eyed junco. That is the colloquial name is Snowbird for that one. And when they fly, they have a flash of white in the tail. They'll come to your feeders. But no, they're here right now, and they're probably going to stick with us for a few months. So, mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, because I have friends up in Pennsylvania that say, we haven't seen any dark-eyed juncos yet. Where's the dark-eyed juncos? Well, I got them here.
Yeah, yeah. They probably already bypassed some of your friends in colder parts of Pennsylvania. They missed them altogether this winter. Yeah. Okay, Carlin, thank you very much for the call.
You are listening to Bird Calls, and we've got Joe next from Nacogdoches County. Joe, you're online next with Cliff. What's your question?
Hello, Cliff.
Hello, Joe.
Got a great show, brother.
Hey, thank you, sir.
I've got two short questions for you.
Okay.
Okay. About a month and a half ago, coming out of the south, headed east-northeast, I saw one lone brown pelican.
Wow.
Is that common?
That is not common. That is
alone. He was a loner. You couldn't mistake it. He was about 300 foot off the ground, flying east northeast.
Yep.
And he looked happy.
Yeah, a lot of our inland records are of single birds, and it's usually tropical storm related.
Right.
So I don't know. Did you tell me the date that you had him? I'm sorry.
About a month and a half ago, brother. 2 months ago.
Yep. So what about Harvey? Could it have been a couple weeks after Hurricane Harvey?
It was before.
Oh, before Harvey. Okay. And we didn't really have anything that I can think of before Harvey, anything significant. But that's usually going to be one of the reasons to get a saltwater inhabiting bird like brown pelican inland is a tropical storm. They get caught up in the system and move inland. So that is a significant record. I'm hoping
it was a sight to behold.
Yeah,
brother.
Yeah, and
okay.
That's pretty neat.
It was a beauty.
Yeah, very cool, Joe. Thank you. What's your other question?
Second question: buzzards.
Okay.
Are known scavengers.
Yep.
Will they hit live prey?
Well, they don't really have the ability to catch and kill live prey, and I don't think you're going to eat on something that's still live, maybe just barely kicking. I don't want to get into some graphic details, but the answer typically is no. It's got to be dead, and that's why you'll see vultures circle until the critter is fully dead. Yeah.
Listen, brother. You're an expert.
Hey.
I appreciate your show and your knowledge.
Hey,
take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that very much, Joe. Thank you.
And thank you, Joe, and all of the callers tonight. We're going to go now to our conservation tip to close out this episode of Bird Calls.
In this episode, we're going to talk about becoming a citizen scientist. Did you know that your observations of birds and other wildlife could be useful to others? Are you a bird watcher who'd like to bird watch with a purpose, where your sightings might assist with conservation efforts? If so, consider collecting citizen science data. It's super easy to get involved. One way that's just around the corner is to join in on a Christmas bird count in your area. Initiated in the year 1900 and growing to thousands of counts around the world today, this is the oldest citizen science project in the birdwatching community. Contact your local Audubon chapter for information on counts near you. Another way to get involved is to submit your sightings from field trips or even from your backyard to eBird and iNaturalist. Submitting your sightings to one or both will also strengthen your ability as a field observer, because both have expert reviewers to assist you if you've encountered something very unusual, or in the case of iNaturalist, with the identification of a species. Citizen science data are often used in conservation efforts. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, for instance, uses eBird data for rare species in need of conservation, like they did with the recent federal listing of the threatened for a species of shorebird known as the red knot. So consider bird watching with a purpose by submitting your sightings to citizen science projects that want data. Investigate Christmas bird counts, eBird, and iNaturalist, just to name a few. do it for the birds.
Yeah, right. Cliff, I want to thank you for joining me this week for Bird Calls from Red River Radio.
Always fun.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. He is the statewide non-game ornithologist at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Bird Calls is produced by Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford and Bill Beckett as the producers. Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell helped us out tonight. This program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next, and this is Red River Radio, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KDAQ Shreveport.